Order. The time is 3:04. Present for the meeting are Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Tuck, Representative Johansson, Co-Chair Edgman, myself, Representative Millett. The first thing on our agenda today is we're going to have a overview of the barley fuel project, and like to invite Bryce to come up and start his presentation. And just for the recording, could you state your name and your affiliation, please?
Yes, thank you. My name is Bryce Wrigley. I represent the Alaska Farm Bureau. I'm also a barley farmer in Delta. Appreciate the committee co-chairs for allowing me the opportunity to present some information about barley as a renewable fuel. One of the things that is kind of curious about the United States, because of tremendous resource capacity that we haven't been as tuned in to the opportunity for alternative energy sources as Europe has been. Barley and other grains have been being used in Europe for a long time to heat homes, and we are just beginning to see that now. One of the interesting things that we should consider, though, in spite of our many resources that we have, we certainly should be looking at those lessons that have been learned and information has been gathered from the other countries who have progressed beyond our present position, and take advantage of those lessons that they've learned. Barley is a resource that is easily grown in Alaska. It is one that by developing its use as a fuel, we can use the other resources that the state has, including its agricultural land and its citizens. For a comparison with fuel oil, one bushel of barley has the same B2 equivalent as 2.8 gallons of fuel oil. A bushel of barley at its most expensive packaging, which is in 50-pound bags, is $5.52 a bushel. 2.8 gallons of fuel oil at the rate that at the price that I paid this winter in Delta, 2.8 gallons cost $8.29. We can compare by converting this to per million BTU price. You guys can't even see the screen. So, but anyway, there's 393,000 BTUs in a bushel of barley. There's 142,000 BTUs in a gallon of oil. 85% is the efficiency rating of both furnaces, which is a reasonable rating for home heating appliances. To look at the pocketbook of an average family, if a 1,500 square foot home takes 100 gallons of oil oil to heat, it's going to cost that family about $300 a month. If they were heating with barley, it would cost take 40 pounds a day for a total of 0.6 ton per month at a cost of $138. There's a lot of benefits that we can consider using barley for. It's the most renewable resource grown in Alaska. It has a carbon cycle of 1 year. Wood, which is the most common form of alternative energy that we use currently, has a 100-year harvest cycle in the interior forest. Barley has much lower particulate levels than wood does. Some of the cities have kind of got into trouble with the spike in prices. A lot of residents rushed out and bought the outdoor wood-burning furnaces, smoked up their yards, smoked up their neighborhoods, and now some of the cities are looking at some way of converting those or changing those out. Barley does not have that level of particulate, so it comes in underneath the EPA particulate thresholds for clean air, which is a problem when it gets cold. It's not a hazardous substance, as is fuel oil, and so it's easier to ship or safer to ship to the villages. It can be shipped as a commodity as opposed to a hazardous substance. And so it's cheaper, or excuse me, it's safer to ship and to store. Another advantage is that anytime agriculture products are sold, the agri-seeds tend to stay in the community. They turn over up to 7 times in a community before they eventually make their way out of the economy. This is known as the multiplier effect in economics. As opposed to that, oil purchases tend to stay in the state about 2 times, turn over in the state 2 times before they make their way out of the state. And of course, at any time we can reduce the amount of fuel consumption that we use, then that reduces the amount that we have to import from other countries. Our current production capability has always been subject to the existing markets. They've always been the limiting factor to grain production. Last year, there were about 4,000 acres that were planted. level has been kind of settled on by the farmers because as markets were not available, they stopped production or curtailed production to meet that demand instead of just sitting on a bunch of surplus. However, because barley is such an easy crop to grow, within 2 years it would certainly be possible to have 18,000 acres in Delta if the market was available. And within 3 years, it's conceivable that there could be 25,000 acres. The ground is there, capability is there, but the markets are not. By the year 2015, 25,000 additional acres will have come out of CRP, a conservation reserve program, and would be able to be put back into production again for a total of 50,000 acres. In the United States, there are 2 million acres a year that is lost, 2 million acres of farmland that is lost to urbanization or urban encroachment every year. That's 2 million acres that is lost and can never be reclaimed. Nowhere else in the country is there such an opportunity or the possibility of putting an immense resource of land back into production as there is in Alaska. Depending on which report you look at, which survey you look at, there's anywhere between 8.9 and 18.5 million acres in Alaska that has been determined to be suitable for agriculture production of some kind. The original state plan called for 500,000 acres to be put into production by 1990. This was in a report in 1992 to the special report to the governor. The reason or the failure to reach that goal was not because the crop could not be raised, rather because the markets did not develop in time for the production that did. As far as production for grain for fuel, an acre will produce about a ton per acre, a ton of barley, which is 40 bushel. So 25,000 acres of barley would produce about 1 million bushel, which in turn would be enough to heat 5,000 homes. Of course, if you run those figures on up, and just for the sake of running them up, let's say 500,000 acres, which was, again, the goal for 1990, and we won't go into that too much more, but if that was run up to 500,000, that'd be enough for 100,000 homes. Biodiesel is another resource that we're looking at. There's been a lot of interest in canola growing, and with new short season varieties of canola, we have the potential producing biodiesel and biodegradable hydraulic oils. There's a lot of interest in doing this. In fact, one farm in Delta this last summer used canola oil in their equipment, in their combines and tractors, and successfully. All that is needed is for thousands of acres to come into production would be a processing plant. We are looking at a small processing plant in Delta right now. A feasibility study is about to be completed. And so that's another possibility. We've just found out that along with biodiesel possibilities for canola, we can also raise with a certain variety canola oil that meets the specifications for food grade canola oil. Looking ahead, Alaskan farmers have been working for years to help create a stable agricultural industry. The original goals of the agriculture program are as valid and important today as they were 30 years ago. In one generation, Alaskan agriculture has accomplished what took 150 years outside to accomplish. Sometimes we get impatient, but it took 150 years to get where they were now, and we have done this in one generation. Alaskan farmers are stepping up to the plate to help the state feed and fuel the state. And what can the state do? One of the things that we would like to see is the state to include barley and other farm products in the state energy plan. Currently, they are not. Another thing is we would like to see barley fuel included in the heating assistance program. At present, the heating assistance program can pay for fuel. I believe it also can pay for firewood, but it can't pay for barley. The state officials might consider a program that would assist villages to make a transition from inefficient, smoking, polluting wood-burning furnaces to more efficient furnaces that would burn barley. And finally, with the goal of reaching 50% renewable fuels by 2025, we'd like to see some funding go into research for other biofuels that can be produced on Alaska farms. when we talk about using barley for fuel, a couple of questions are often asked. One is this ethical? Barley is a natural resource, ought to be used in the manner which is most beneficial. The current livestock demands can be met with the production from 3,000 acres. So anything over 3,000 acres becomes surplus. And too much surplus stymies future production. And so what we would like to do is actually encourage a new market by creating a barley fuel market and promoting that, and then with the understanding or with the goal of bringing up production along with that market, which will in turn stabilize the livestock industry and encourage future livestock owners to invest in those livestock enterprises. Another question is whether there's enough barley to meet feeding needs and also to burn. And current production and current demand, yes, there is. The goal, of course, is to increase both of those together. This is something I think we can do. The one thing that is needed is, like I say, we talked about on the previous slide, is the chance or the opportunity to expand knowledge and the ability to use barley as a resource for heating. So I'm glad to take any questions if anybody has. Oh, I do have one more thing. Let me just. Most of you have probably not had the opportunity to ever be in Delta. Just have a very short presentation here that shows you a little bit about how barley becomes fuel. These are some of the farms in Delta. These farms, it's 120,000 acres total there. These farms have been cleared. The average, these ones we're looking at, average about 2,500 acres apiece. Planting starts in the spring with fertilization and preparation of the ground. After the ground is prepared, then the grain is drilled, either no-till or with grain drill. And then it just grows all summer long. There's no other inputs to do it. It matures on through the summertime until mid-August. This is matured grain. At the time that it's matured, then it's combined. Combines take it in, they separate the grain from the chaff and the straw. Then the grain is augured into trucks. This is what we burn in the stoves, is this grain separated from the straw. There's no other processing that's needed. It's taken to the storage and dumped and stored and it's either used for feed or for fuel. Now this barley stove is mine. Just runs on barley. You'll notice it doesn't have a great big old smokestack coming out the top. Mine, I ran out through the back wall. The smokestack stays cool. Well, it's warm, but it's not hot. It's got a 60-pound hopper that holds the barley in the back. You just dump that in. That lasts a little over a day. So you just top it off every day. Underneath the firebox, there's an ash bin. Collects all the burned up residue. So those familiar with burning wood will notice that it doesn't spend a lot of you don't spend a lot of time cleaning up later. The thing about this stove is that it has a stirring mechanism on it that as the fire is burning, the barley is augered in. It stirs that up and keeps those clinkers broken up to make sure there's complete combustion and that all of the stuff is used. So that's everything I've got. If anybody has any questions, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Bryce. And for the record, Representative Peterson is in attendance to our meeting. He's been here for probably 10 minutes. Thanks for joining us. Does anybody have any questions, Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to say thank you, Bryce, for being here, and thanks for being a farmer. I know that that is a career that is extremely hard, and the men and women that do it, I don't feel are appreciated enough, and so I want to thank you for that. Your video answered some of the questions that I had, except just one more. Does the barley need to be totally dry before you burn it?
No. Actually, it has to be dried in order to store, whether it's for feed or for fuel. When it comes out of the field initially in the season, if it's, you know, if we start by middle of August to the 1st of September, it comes off the field at around 17-18% moisture. We try and dry that down to about 14.5 around there. At that moisture, it will store for a long, long time, I mean forever. And so it doesn't really require, in order for to be barley fuel, it doesn't require any extra effort than we would normally go through just in the process of storing the barley.
Okay, and then the follow-up, Madam Chair, you said that was a barley stove. That's something that's been
specifically? Excuse me, through the chair, I call it a barley stove because that's what I burn in it. It's actually, it was a pellet stove that was designed to burn pellets or corn.
Okay.
And in Lower 48, they do use corn, but you can use barley in them as well.
Okay, and then one more follow-up question. Is canola a bean? Is that its original form? It comes as a bean?
Through the chair, canola is an oil seed.
So similar it's a to, seed that gets compressed to the
very
oil.
Very small seed. It's got about 45 to 50% oil in it. It can actually be crushed, and the oil actually runs out of it. They collect that, screen it, and they can burn it as oil when the temperature is warm. It does gel quicker unless it's actually converted to a biodiesel, in which case it will burn at colder temperatures.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And for the record, Representative Ramos has joined us. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You had mentioned that we'd be able to ramp up production over a 2 or 3 year period. I was wondering how many farmers are currently growing barley in the Delta region, and how many more would get into the business if there was a market for more barley, if you have an idea.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I want to reiterate my comment. This ramped up production is contingent on markets coming on, and that's why we planted 4,000 acres last year as opposed to 24,000 acres.
Right.
But currently, I would guess there's about 7 or 8 farmers planting barley, raising barley right now. There are other farmers who are not raising barley, and primarily because there really isn't a market. Some of the farmers, and this happened several years ago, I don't know if you're familiar with the CRP program. The Conservation Reserve Program was offered by the federal government, and some of the farmers put some ground into CRP because the fact that they didn't have a market for barley, in an effort to keep the ground clean and farmable, they put that in, and they are paid a rental rate on that conservation cover.
Madam Chair, follow up. Thank you. Is that program you're just mentioning, is that for a 10-year period?
It was initially for a 10-year period. It was that was in 1987. In 1997, it was renewed, and then again in 2007, there were staggered offerings made. Some were for 1 year, some were for 3 years, 5 years, and 10 years.
Thank you. Another follow-up?
Representative Peterson.
I was wondering if you've had any studies or have any information as to whether it's more efficient to burn the barley in the stove that you were showing, or to turn it into ethanol and burn it, because I believe barley can be turned into ethanol the same way that corn can, the same method. Am I correct?
It can be. They do make ethanol out of barley. We haven't investigated any of that. The advantage that we see with the barley, using the barley directly as a fuel, is that it's ready to go. We've got it in the bins right now. If somebody wanted to buy a stove and get some barley for it, we'd go out there and we'd open the gate and we'd have them barley. Ethanol is a process that actually would require further inputs, further processing in order to come up with a product. It could be done. Now, whether it could be done cost-effectively, that's something that I don't know.
Okay. Another follow-up.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if we're going to be increasing the planting of barley, and when you harvest it, are there more byproducts that will be created that might create, you know, another market for something else like straw or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, currently all the straw from the acreage harvested right now is primarily used for dog bedding and other large animal bedding, but primarily most of it goes to the dog mushing market. With increased straw production, we would certainly be looking at possibilities of increase of pelletizing the straw, blending it with canola meal, for example. Just incidentally, I found out this morning that that canola, they can actually take the canola meal, which is a byproduct of canola oil, and they get 8,600 BTUs out of a pound of canola meal, which is the same B2 output as anthracite coal, which is, you know, the highest grade coal that we have. Hmm. So there's some significant possibilities there. If that was blended, put in a pellet form, then that's certainly a possibility. And we would be hoping, I'm sorry, through the chair, we would be hoping that, that these kind of markets would continue to develop.
One last question, please. Peterson. Thank you. And I was wondering if you had an opinion as to whether it would be advantageous if we had a licensed grain elevator in the Delta area?
Through the chair, that's a concept that we've discussed it to some extent as farmers and producers. Last winter, we had a surplus of barley, and there was a shortage of barley in Lower 48. One of the problems we ran into when we tried to ship it down was the fact that we did not have a licensed elevator in the state. And that created some problems because of the fact that if we send the grain down there and to a licensed elevator, they inspect it down there and find out that it was, you know, didn't meet spec or something, then we've lost, and the grain had to be shipped down a carload at a time, 100 ton at a time, so that would be 100 ton of grain at a whack that we're taking a hit on. If there was a licensed elevator that could actually do that inspection and service those kind of contracts here. So that's one part of the answer. The other part is at this point, I'm not really sure that we want to look at an export market so far. With potential production, I mean, let's say, for example, that the Nananatol-Chacket area was opened up for agricultural production, another 155,000 acres, and we wound up with 300,000 acres that could grow barley. Now we're talking about acreage that we could actually look at an export market, because obviously there's no way we could support that market in the state. So some possibilities are great there. So on the one hand, I agree that a licensed elevator would certainly be an advantage when we're selling barley, when we're storing barley, and because it would meet the federal regulations. But if it was a licensed elevator for the purpose of exporting barley, I guess my personal feeling is that let's supply the in-state demand and let's create in-state markets as a renewable resource before we look at shipping it out, extra costs and things like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the point of the barley and burning it in a stove to supplant fossil fuels? You mentioned wood specifically, but I mean, is this to supplant fossil fuel use with renewables?
Through the chair, I used to burn. Well, I used to burn fuel in my house, and so yes, my recommendation is to use it to supplant fossil fuels. That's one of the ways that we can save the fuel, and hopefully import less of it. However, I mentioned also about the smoking issue with some of the outdoor wood furnaces and stuff and causing the EPA levels to be triggered and fines possibly to be levied against some of those cities, Fairbanks in particular. And so anything that is cleaner burning than what we're using now or more cost effective than what we're using right now, in my mind, is certainly an advantage that we ought to look at.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johansson.
I've heard this question asked about ethanol in the Lower 48. What, for a gallon of gas to get barley to your stove, how much fossil fuel do you burn to get? I mean, do you burn 1 gallon of fossil fuel to get
a gallon back?
To get barley to your stove to save a gallon of home heating fuel? Is there any relationship that you've looked at there?
We have looked at that. And the answer is for what we're talking about, no. Again, ethanol, when we talk about processing ethanol, there's tremendous energies involved and efforts involved in heat generation because it has to cook and ferment and different things. And those processes are not involved in the barley fuel as we're discussing. So what we're producing as feed is actually the same stuff that we're producing as fuel. I can take it out of the same bin. I can put it in a ration for hogs or cattle, or I can put it in my stove and burn it. And so there's really no additional effort needed there. As far as the fuel use to create it or to bring it to that point, then no. It's I figured it out, and it seems like it's of like a 6-to-1 ratio.
And one more question, if I may follow. You mentioned feed as well. Mm-hmm. The relationship of so barley right now is basically being used for livestock feed?
Primarily for livestock feed.
Okay. And then following the same question that's brought up in the lower 48 with the price of feed stock that's now going to ethanol production having an effect on mm-hmm. the price of goods at the grocery store, what is the story on this?
Okay. We kind of are in a, through the chair, we're kind of in a closed market here. Because of the cost of transportation, it's really not feasible to ship it out. And so what we can produce in the state and consume in the state, then those are really the factors that we need to look at. When we talk about the price or the impact of using barley for fuel and raising the cost of feed to the point that, or even making a shortage of feed, it takes about 3,000 acres to supply the in-state demand for livestock feed right now. So any production over that becomes surplus. An excess surplus stymies production, stymies future production. So the idea, as I mentioned, is to increase the market, and along with that market increase, to increase production so that market can be met. And in the process, what we do is stabilize the livestock, or stabilize the fuel, feed source, so that livestock producers can be comfortable that they're going to have feed there for the livestock. For example, a cattle operation takes 18 months from the time you start a cattle operation until you have a calf or a steer to sell. So for 18 months, they're going to have to feed that animal. They need to know that 18 months out, they're still going to have feed there. That's pretty hard to do when you're just raising enough for the livestock market in the state. And so the livestock market kind of languishes just because there's really not enough of a surplus to generate that. It takes a surplus of about at least 15% to encourage new livestock production, just to give them that cushion, if you will, that there's going to be enough there for when my animals are a year old.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Any other questions? Representative Tuck?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. The stove that we saw in the demonstration, is there furnaces that are built for barley as well, so you can heat water and, aside from being a wood stove, heat your whole facility?
Yes. Thank you. Through the chair. There are a number of options there. The one I showed is 45,000 BTU, and that's just radiant heat, has a fan on it, blows out. However, they do have barley, what we call barley boilers. I'm not sure if that's the correct term, but they're boilers that operate on barley. And there are a number of those around the state also running. And these barley fields, I've got a stove. Gary Sonicson has a stove. He's here in the room with us. A number of people in the area and the community have stoves, and in Fairbanks and North Pole particularly, a number of them have these barley boilers. They come in different sizes. As mentioned, mine is 45,000 BTUs, about the same size as a large monitor, a very automatic operation. However, the barley boilers, we'll call them that, they range in size up to 250,000 BTUs, so they're big enough for a larger house, and they basically fit in there. They fit into your existing heat transfer system, and they can be used instead of fuel oil or the outdoor wood furnaces, wood boilers.
Thank you. So primarily it's for residential that we're looking at using the barley fields for. Well, you're not going to be generating electricity or anything like that.
They certainly can be. Barley can certainly be used for generating electricity with a solid biomass boiler or a solid biomass burner. Yes, and there are those things out there, but they'll basically burn anything that's under 50% moisture. So barley is certainly an option for that. Another advantage that I failed to mention, and when you get into the housing and versus commercial use, some of the people that are using these in Fairbanks do use them for commercial use, heating shops, heating businesses. But another thing that I failed to mention was the possibility for the people in the villages. The villages, it's a hazardous material that we're shipping along the water. Anytime there's a spill, whether it's a spill transferring it from the barge to the holding tank, whether it's a spill coming from the holding tank to somebody drives over a line, or they put air in a tank and it blows the end out of the tank, then you got a spill that runs right down into the water, and then you got a major cleanup problem. You spill barley, you go out to shovel, you shovel it back into the thing. What's left, the birds come along and eat it up. It falls in the water, big deal. I mean, there's nothing dangerous about it. It's easily recoverable as much as you want to recover. Throw a little bit of dirt in there. The ash that is left over is, we've had it analyzed. It's quite high, actually, in the fertilizers, nitrogen, phosphate, and potash. So it can be put on the gardens. That's not even a hazardous substance.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you run any projection as to how many jobs might be created if we were to increase the barley production and use it to, you know, to heat homes?
Yeah. You know, I haven't. I know that I know that when we talk about agriculture and job creation, there's a tremendous number of jobs that are not directly farmers, but that are tied to agriculture, processing, packaging, shipping, all of these things, and in agriculture in general. Obviously, there would be some increases in jobs, not only from the standpoint of direct labor and facilitating the growth of another 25,000 acres of barley, for example, but also from the standpoint of those who might retail or wholesale. You know, the farmer ideally would wholesale this product to somebody else who would then bag it, package it however they wanted it, and then retail it, ship it out to other places. Depending on how far out afield you want to go, then certainly some jobs could be created. They would be shipping, ideally they'd be shipping barley on barges to the coastal, to the villages along the river system. They might be shipping it just down the road in a truck. So there's some jobs. As far as the number of jobs, no, we haven't calculated any of that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much does a bushel of barley weigh?
48 pounds is the official weight. We usually round that to 50 pounds.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Bryce, thank you very much
thank
for your
you
presentation. It was very informative.
Appreciate
Representative
it.
Dahlstrom is going to come visit you, she says.
I am. And, Madam Chair, I just wonder, will my house smell like fresh baked barley bread or soup if I eat it this way? So.
That's a good question.
That'd be a reason enough.
And at this point, we will hear a presentation of HB 44 from Representative Chenault. Welcome to the House Special Committee on Energy, Speaker Chenault. That is a lovely tie.
Too bad the camera's not on, Madam Chairman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for having me here. House Bill 44 was introduced in an effort to address the state's energy needs, especially for winterization and energy efficiency programs, and also to provide an impetus for in-state gas line. House Bill 44 pre-authorizes the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority to issue bonds for energy-related programs and projects. The bill also gives the legislature's approval for the Permanent Fund Corporation to invest up to $1 billion in in-state gas projects. And although the legislature has authorized a number of these projects, either through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and has made appropriations to the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, I believe now is the time to progress these needs to a higher level. In particular, the state's gas needs can't wait. Madam Chairman, we're looking at a couple of projects, big projects. Certainly, I think all Alaskans would like to see gas move off the slope. And, you know, we've got two big projects, the one we dealt with through the AGEA process and certainly the Denali project. But the completion date of those two projects are out as far as 2020, and I think that's probably close. And in today's economic times, we certainly have no guarantee that either of those projects will move forward. So what this would allow to do, Madam Chairman, is you know, we have areas such as Fairbanks, Matsu, and the Cook Inlet areas, which in the next number of years will require a gas supply, either that or a whole new energy supply. And what we've done with this is try to also look at, you know, by processing liquids that would come down the line, how we would take care of some of the needs in rural Alaska and try to get rural Alaska off of the high cost of diesel. So, Madam Chairman, I would prefer personally, I'm a private individual, private sector type guy, and I would like to see a private corporation step up to the bar and build a line. This bill simply, in my mind, allows the state to, if we so choose to, get involved in a project that would bring energy to at a cost to Alaskans and to in-state gas use. So, Madam Chairman, that's pretty much my opening statement, and I'll try to answer questions. If I don't have the answer, I'm sure my trusty staff will bail me out.
Thank you, Representative Chenault. Representative Dahlstrom, would you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a motion that we adopt the CS for House Bill Number 44, Version R, with attached Joe Physical Notes so that we can work off it.
Thank you. Hearing no objections. Is there questions for the sponsor of the bill? Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Speaker, I'm glad to have you here, so I'm going to be delicate in my questions, but I've sat through an AGDA board meeting, and their plan is to build a pipe to Glen Allen and then wait for a large pipe to come by. Their plan further is to take plastic pipe and run it to the turbines in Glen Allen, Delta, North Pole, to change the feedstock for Golden Valley from diesel to natural gas, which right now would yield nominal savings. And best case for my community, for the residents in my district, $10 a month. They don't offer gas for some time. And then, frankly, ANGDA is very cavalier in suggesting that if some other private sector entity, because I share your interest in private sector first, if some other private sector entity doesn't come forward, then they'll just keep on building north. But they are pretty casual, throwing around $3 or $4 billion with B, a little casual for my taste. I mean, I'm a small business person just like you, Mr. Speaker, and in the world I come from, but we measure money, you know, we measure twice and cut once, and they're taking pretty mighty big swings. That's my thought. How do you feel about that?
And through the chair, Representative Rammer, certainly in a year, 2 years, 5 years, I certainly don't know what any one of these particular projects will look like. We can certainly come out of the chute and say we want a line from Prudhoe Bay to Wasilla. And that may sound good, but the logistics may certainly not work out. While I have had conversations with Mr. Hines and ANGDA on some of their issues, I certainly don't know all of their proposals that are out there. But I certainly think what this does is it allows us to get some of these issues out on the table and at least talk about them. The governor has proposed that she's going to have a proposal coming out. Certainly don't know what that is right now. I don't know whether I could get on board or not get on board. But Representative Ramirez, I think that you're well aware, I know you certainly are, of the gas issue and the gas needs in your community. I know that probably within, I think, about 40 million cubic feet of gas at the coldest point this winter in the Cook Inlet region, that is currently on the gas supply, that they were that close to the maximum of the limits that they feel the system could operate under. While that sounds like a lot, it certainly isn't very much a very big segment to be able to hang your hat on that they're going to be able to supply gas to us for forever. I certainly think if we would have had a few more days of cold weather, and certainly if we would have lost a compressor in the Cook Inlet, you would have seen Anchorage and the surrounding areas probably get a little bit cold. And certainly, is this the answer to the problem? I don't know, but it's a question that I want thrown out there to try to dig through in committee and try to see if there's something that we can come up with to spur a pipeline. Certainly, I would rather see a private corporation, and I, my intent with this, and I think it's been interpreted, is my intent is that I want the state to build the line and not private industry, and that's certainly not a fact. But I certainly want to have all the options out on the table so that if a private entity doesn't go forward, that we have a backup plan.
Representative Ramos?
Yeah, follow-up. Mr. Speaker, through the chair, do you have any concerns that a quasi-state entity, which is an extension of the sovereign, competing against a private sector entity, will scare off the private sector entity?
Madam Chairman, through the chair, Representative Ramos, personally, no. Personally, I think that if a private corporation is going to build this project, then they've got to have the faith that they have the know-how and the ability to build it. And if it's a profitable project, then they're going to move their project forward. And I certainly think that the state should assist them in every way they can.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any other questions for the sponsor? Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Madam Chair. Mr. Speaker, I was wondering if you've got any input from the Permanent Fund Board on this. Will this meet their requirement to return the maximum amount from their investments?
Certainly, Madam, through the chair, Representative Peterson, said Ramos, but I knew that wasn't you. You know, basically, this bill is suggestive to the Permanent Fund Board. Certainly, they have the prudent investor rules that they have to abide by. That's in statute, and certainly we're not telling them or asking them to invest in a project in Alaska that doesn't meet their investment requirements, but certainly we want to make sure that they, as the Permanent Fund Board, know that we, as the legislature, feel that it's an important enough issue in the state that if it meets their requirements, we certainly want them to invest in an in-state project.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a rate of return that's kind of forecasted with potential projects that are out there, what the permanent fund dividend may be getting on their bonds?
You know, that'd probably be a better question for the Permanent Fund Board, but certainly they're not getting a rate of return today as they were a year and a half ago. And you know, I certainly don't know what the criteria that they use to make their investments either in real estate or in other areas, but they can certainly tell you that, Representative Tuck.
Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, as regarding these projects that we have right here, not how much you're making as the general income, but how much is a rate of return that we might be able to see from these projects forecasted?
You know, I don't, through the chair, Representative Tuck, I certainly don't have that information. You probably wouldn't know that information until some type of bond package or other instrument was put out there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the sponsor? Thank you, Representative Chenault. Are you going to stay for the public testimony?
You bet.
Great. And at this time, we'll open up SCS for.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
You bet. For HB 44 to public testimony. I have Harold Hines. Are you on the line?
Madam Chair, I am on the line.
All right. Would you like to state your name and affiliation and give us your testimony, please?
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Harold Hines. I head up the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. I have submitted to you three pages of sort of talking points related to ANGDA's support of HB 44. I would propose to go through them pretty rapidly, if it's all right with the chair.
That'd be great, Harold.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I wanted to speak to the fact that the general idea of HB 44 and the use of the public corporations of the state to help advance a number of different energy projects, I think is a wise advocacy by the legislature, in that it builds on a strength unique to Alaska, the public corporations. It keeps the legislature directly involved in the policy and broad direction, but still focuses the individual project and financial decisions down to the level of public boards that operate in very full public view and have a very strong fiduciary responsibility and history. In particular, there is an opportunity, I think, right now to recognize that as the legislature meets and you consider all the budget and fiscal constraints that are on you because of low oil prices, this may be the time to maximize the leverage of, you might say, the cash and use a bonding approach to advance infrastructure in the state through bonding. And also, the state, as you know, despite downturn in oil prices, still has an extraordinarily strong credit position, far stronger than businesses and certainly the utilities throughout the state. And any opportunity to kind of extend that umbrella of creditworthiness, I think, again, will be very good for the consumer interests in Alaska. In particular, I wanted to point out to the committee two, I think, important successes that have occurred in the history of financing Alaska energy projects, that it is certainly our interest in trying to see if those successes can be replicated. And in particular, the state played a crucial role in the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project in moving the project forward, in obtaining very favorable financing, and again, a benefit enjoyed by many consumers of electricity produced by it today. And then also the municipal government of Anchorage through Anchorage Municipal Light and Power in the 90s was able to purchase a one-third interest in the Beluga gas field. And if you look at the history of that and what it has meant to the consumer, that purchase in the ground of gas leads to some of the very lowest electric bills in the United States right now. We think both of those kind of opportunities of building on those successes exist out in the future, and in particular, as the North Slope gas comes to market, those opportunities will present themselves again. On the second page, I just provided a brief summary of the provisions of the ANGDA statute, AS41.41, that relate to the references in the bill and the sponsor statement covering the issuance of bonds, the necessity of authorization of the bonds by the legislature, and then also the broad purposes of the authority. And then on the third page, I wanted to just take a few minutes and discuss some of the ideas we see that between basically now and as short a time as the next convening of the 26th legislature next January of 2010, some of the things that we think might be on the table, and it would be good that they were pre-authorized to be dealt with by the board of directors in looking at a bonding proposals. First of all, generally, the bonding at ANGDA, we have looked at one way, probably its greatest value, is in lowering the tariff of cost to the consumer by providing lower cost financing on the public side of a public-private partnership. That effect can be considerable because of both the tax status and, more importantly, the creditworthiness of a state entity. Secondly, all the projects in Alaska, because of the fact that they are kind of basin opening, first project out of the chute, they have a higher risk profile than many lenders would like to take on. And as such, one of the things that, again, the bonding by a public corporation can do is provide a bridge between the sort of pre-construction construction period and the sort of stabilized in operation type financial picture that many institutions are used to. And that risk reduction aspect of financing, again, has a long-term benefit to the consumer in terms of lower transportation costs, lower costs passed through to the consumer of the energy move through a gas pipeline. And then finally, there's there is the opportunity for, we believe, purchase of gas in the ground. There is the opportunity for commitments, shipping commitments in the big pipeline that could be need to be made within the matter of less than a year. Both of those offer an opportunity for basically a low interest bond to work against the higher earning rate of return of either, for instance, an oil explorer developer. And the ability to sort of cash them out and buy things in the ground offers the opportunity of long, stable prices at a considerable discount. The three specific things we looked at, I delineated there. One is, again, in support of any private sector pipeline company here in Alaska on an in-state issue, we can see that ANGA could play a role in financing a debt portion of that pipeline. And again, as long as that benefit was some sort of public benefit, the flow through of it, we think that would be a very positive thing. Secondly, the open season that is slated for sometime in 2010 by both TransCanada and Denali Pipeline on the big pipeline will require that significant commitment to be made. The again, the opportunity there to use debt and in particular bonding debt associated with a public corporation of the state is pretty powerful in allowing those utilities to make those commitments. Previous work we've done indicates that the utilities need all their current debt capacity to meet the needs for basic power generation, power transmission, and other putting pipe in the ground. They don't have the ability to finance any other longer-term commitments, and if they miss that opportunity during the open season, the long-term penalties to the Alaska public are very large. And then finally, again, there is clearly gas that could become available on the North Slope in the ground. There are certainly interior basins, Copper River Basin, and even in Cook Inlet, opportunities potentially for securing some longer-term supplies. And then I went on to recite some other things that would not necessarily be items that ANGA would look at bonding, but we believe bonding by a public corporation of the state might play an important role, in particular ADA, as it relates to both a wholesale propane facility and delivery systems from the North Slope, Fairbanks Natural Gas, proposed LNG facility at Prudhoe Bay, and the associated trucking delivery. Any of the sort of pipe and logistical systems, pipe handling, preparation, storage for any Alaska pipeline could be financed with Alaska Railroad Bonds. And then finally, the Alaska Permanent Fund, not as the only purchaser, but as one of several subscribers purchasing bonds for any of the Alaska energy projects. Those are just a quick run through of some of the ideas that flow out of our reading of House Bill 44. And ANGDA certainly urges your support and passage thereof.
Thank you, Harold. Is there any questions for Harold? Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Ramos has a question for you, Harold.
Thank you. Hi, Harold. How are you?
Very fine, Representative Ramos.
Are you having conversations with NSTAR?
Not today. No, sir.
Can you, yesterday, last week, last month, do you have any plan for this week, next month?
I don't have any plans other than to be at the hearing Friday and certainly explore whether there are things that can be talked about.
Madam Chair, I'm not familiar with the hearing on Friday. I'm not.
Representative Ramos has a question about the hearing you're referring to on Friday, Harold.
Oh, I'm sorry. Again, on Friday, Senate Resources, I believe, is holding a hearing at which the indication I had received was that potentially the administration would be providing some guidance as to how to proceed on the in-state gas issues.
Thank you. Follow-up, Madam
Representative Ramos.
Harold, what would you do with the $250 million? What would if you issued the bonds, what would they be for right now?
point, we have not developed a specific debt proposal, a bonding proposal. The three items I outlined to you, for instance, one of them would be a bond proposal of $250 million would cover a portion of an in-state spur line. It would cover a smaller portion of a line reaching all the way to the North Slope. It would demonstrate in either of those cases the state's support and commitment to advancing those pipelines with a private sector pipeline company. It would also provide an opportunity for a public corporation of the state to be part of the development of the benefits for the Alaskan consumer, and in particular for the Alaska utilities. The utility shippers' potential commitment during the open season, the middle of next year, is probably measured in billions of dollars. Again, $250 million would provide a good start towards that, and again, at least signal the willingness of the state to participate and be active in making those commitments. And then finally, I don't know exactly how things are going to play later this summer as we start to see events on the North Slope and the foothills, in the Copper River Valley, in the Nanana Basin, or frankly even in Cook Inlet. As any of those opportunities would develop, $250 million would buy a fair hunk of gas in the ground and allow somebody to proceed with development of it under very favorable terms.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ramos.
Harold, if I could take you to page 3 of the bill, line starts on line 14, but primarily it's line 15, 16, and 17. Can you explain this part of it to me? The Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority shall negotiate with interested parties and shall enter into agreements with interested parties to provide revenue sufficient to accomplish the purposes described in this subsection. You just went through three or four things that you could do with the money, but this suggests that you would have to figure out how to service the debt of that $250 million. So what would you, how do you address lines 15, 16, and 17 on page 3?
The agreement with interested parties would be, for instance, in the case of a purchase of gas in the ground, would be in the sense of both an aggregated and collective sense of a gas supply co-op, for instance, and it would be against the subscription of, for instance, the electric utilities that need gas to generate electrical power. Ranging from, in your area, Golden Valley, Copper Valley, MEA, and on down to Chugach and MLNT. Through those types of companies, there would be a commitment to take the gas. In terms of the shipping commitments, in a similar way, those companies that wanted to receive gas from the North Slope may wish to make shipping commitments to lower their longer-term cost of acquiring that supply. And again, it may be that in terms of the total tariff structure of an in-state pipeline, the public debt portion of that would have pledged against it the shipping commitments made to move gas through the pipeline.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Ramos.
Harold, I just have several questions that center on this particular portion of what we're doing. And I'm also looking at the sectional analysis. And, what kind of cash would you have to generate annually to service the $250 million? And what part of this would be a closed loop, so to speak, so that you're using the $250 million to acquire an asset that generates revenue so that you can service the debt? Because I'm unclear. You're fingering out in so many different directions and acquiring a gas supply, but without delineating that gas and actually monetizing it, I don't quite understand how you're going to generate the revenue and or lower the tariffs. I just I it's one thing to have the power to issue $250 million in bonds, and then this says that you get to, you shall negotiate with interested parties and shall enter into agreements with interested parties to provide revenue sufficient. I just want to know exactly what your plans would be with this $250 million.
Representative Ramirez, the authorization here simply delegates to the board the arrangement of the terms of the financing and bonding package, which would be developed in specific for whatever the potential was at that point in time. By way of example, if the Otna well in the Glen Ellen area was to be indicative of a fairly large resource, several hundred billion cubic feet, we might wish to make develop a financing package for that that would acquire in a longer-term supply of that gas in the ground and provide financing for the development of that, and at the same time permit it to be start to hooked up by pipeline.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ramirez.
So, Harold, I just want to be I just want to be clear on what you would do with the money. I mean, it says you know the on line six of page three it says is authorized to issue bonds, and then on line 12 it says may issue the bonds in a single issuance or in several issues, and then on line 15 it says shall negotiate with interested parties and shall enter an agreement with interested parties to provide revenue sufficient to accomplish the purposes described in this subsection. So how far along in the process would it be before you were able to close the loop and actually generate revenue that would benefit consumers, that would lead to lower tariffs? I mean, when your oral testimony, your testimony suggests that you could go in three or four different directions, but it doesn't necessarily lead to servicing the debt, and that's the concern I have, is that it moves in many different directions, very many ambitious directions that most Alaskans would applaud, but it doesn't necessarily satisfy the requirement that this bill seems to suggest that you will service the debt. Doesn't this lack an event that triggers your ability to service the debt? I mean, what you described didn't really service the debt, it just furthered along different increments of a project, unless I misunderstood.
Representative Ramirez, through the chair. On page two of the handout, I provided a brief summary of the statutory bonding provisions of the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. And as you can see at the bottom of that page, there are several very broad purposes under which the authority is directed to undertake certain functions. The powers then of the authority include the issuance of bonds to further that, with the one limitation on the issuance of bonds, which is that they must be authorized by the legislature. And as I understand this bill, Representative Ramirez, it is intended to pre-authorize and delegate to the Board of Directors of ANGDA the authority to bond for the purposes specified there up to $250 million. And in that, the board is required to operate with the same fiduciary responsibility after exercising the same level of due diligence they would provided for in the statutes. And again, this is the idea that the legislature is encouraging the public corporation of the state to move forward and do what it can to help advance broadly the in-state gas issue. And one of the ways to do that is for the legislature to put the onus on the board of directors to look for those opportunities. And if they pass muster in a financial sense and in a fiduciary sense after due diligence, then proceed ahead.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ramirez.
I'm I'm fond of the chairman of ANGDA. I like him personally. But I also, as a member of the private sector who puts capital at risk, I'm nervous about people that are cowboys. And in some of the conversations I've had with the chairman, who I respect enormously, but the suggestion has been made that, well, you know, we'll spend $1 billion to go to Glen Allen, and if nothing else works out, we'll just keep building north. And this idea of throwing around billions of dollars, or in this case, $250 million, makes me nervous. I don't disagree with the establishment of the authority or the rights that it has. I'm just questioning lines 15 through 17 on page 3, whether this specific bill requires ANGDA with this $250 million to service that debt by generating a revenue, a proven revenue source before you can before you would move forward with spending the $250 million. Is that how you understand lines 15 through 17 of page 3?
Representative Ramirez, through the chair, I understand that to develop a bonding package, we would have to face very clearly and very clearly define how revenue requirements would be developed to service that debt. And the looks we've taken in the past suggest that the public financing at the right moment can play a very key role in advancing a private sector project. It also can play a very key role in allowing the electric utilities to secure better long-term financial commitments and rates for their consumers than if they are left to sort of a monthly type basis. And both of those would be objectives under consideration for financing. It may be that after the passage of this bill, that if no proposals are developed that pass muster, then nothing will happen.
So finally, Madam Chair,
Representative Ramos.
I just want to be clear that if you get this $250 million, you won't place the $250 million unless you have an ability to service that debt. Am I reading this page 3 of this bill correctly, in that you will, this isn't for fishing expeditions, this is actually to have a closed loop deal where you actually make enough money to service the $250 million debt. Am I reading it correctly?
Representative Ramirez, through the chair, ANGDA has believed that all the debt needs to be commercially term debt. In other words, it needs to be financed through general funding banking type institutions. And the last time I looked, all those institutions require very clear debt coverage and other things. There is nothing in this bill that I believe relieves ANGDA and its board or any other of the public corporations from their fiduciary responsibility and their responsibility to look at all business propositions, because they are businesses, with a high level of due diligence.
Madam Chair, I don't mean to belabor the point.
Representative Ramos.
But for specific ANGDA bonding opportunities in 09 and 010, you say purchase of gas supply in-ground on North Slope, Copper River Valley, Interior, Cook Inlet. How do you service the $250 million debt by purchasing in-ground gas supply and then not delineating that gas supply and monetizing it in some way? What do I not understand?
Representative Ramirez, through the chair, for instance, the purchase of a gas resource in the ground would be a transaction where, in essence, for cash, you are buying a long-term deliverability of gas to be produced over an extended period of time. If you look at the difference of the finance interest rate of a bond like we would be talking about and the earning rate of return of a major exploration development company, there's a lot of opportunity to strike a bargain that is good for both sides and yet provides a long-term, stable, discounted price. That would be the objective. If the objective was met in the course of that design of the bond package, then in turn, the long-term pledge would be of the ultimate consumers. And again, I would equate it to the past success of Municipal Light and Power and the purchase of one-third interest in the Beluga gas field, which in essence was the equivalent of a cash purchase from one of the owners there. And it is something that has been produced over a long period of time and provides a very low and reasonable, stable price for its customers.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Is there any other questions for Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Harold, I was just reading this, and it looks to me like unless you had a commitment by suppliers that had gas in the ground during your open season, that you would not be building the pipeline because you wouldn't be able to get the financing unless you already had the commitment to get the gas. Is that correct?
The intention here is to, number one, recognize that one of the singular events we have no control over the timeline of is the open season of the big pipeline, which will occur a little over a year from now. At that time of that event, some people are going to have to come forward with who have gas supplies and make commitments to ship them. And in this case, ship them, as we would understand both the TransCanada proposal and the Denali pipeline proposal, ship them basically to the lower 48. Some of those people may be interested in shipping down a leg to Valdez, and I believe the Port Authority is pursuing that avenue. Some may be interested in providing that gas into, for instance, the utility market in the Cook Inlet area or in the Fairbanks area. Those commitments, again, are going to be costed out based on where the gas is purchased, what's the nature of the commitment, and how long it is, and the surety of it. If you look at the terms of the open season requirements on the big gas pipeline, if that pipeline's open season is successful and the state has not participated, and by the state, I mean the utilities in the state have not participated, we find ourselves at a great disadvantage in terms of both tariff structure and other arrangements in the future. If that pipeline's open season or the pipeline's open season are not successful, then I think you're back to looking at how one then goes ahead and sources gas in the longer run to meet the community's needs. And if at that point it becomes clear that a big pipeline isn't going to happen, then I think you have to look at your other cards. The other part that will become much clearer at that open season in a little year from now is the timeline and what the timeline is and what will happen and how it will all move forward. Because the commitments at that point will have a time frame against them. At this point, I'm not able to tell you whether that big pipeline is a sure thing. I don't know if either or both will garner enough support to move forward. But I am certain that if we do not, on an in-state consumption basis, participate in the commercial terms of that open season, we put ourselves at great disadvantage. And the participation on commercial terms means that you need to be prepared to make very major financial commitments. And while there'll always be contingencies around them, and there'll always be ifs around them, you still have to work forward on the basis that they will happen and that you are putting forward meaningful pledges of taking the gas and of being willing to pay for it.
Thank you.
Yep. I'm Representative Ramirez.
Harold, is your plan still to spend $1.3 billion to build a pipe out to Glen Allen and wait for a larger pipe to come by?
Representative Ramos, through the chair, ANGDA's plans continue to be to be able to work with any of several different projects. In particular, we are very interested, as I say, in seeing if commitments are made in a little over a year from now. If they are on the big pipe, that represents, based on all the work we've been able to do, the best long-term opportunity for the Alaskan consumer. We believe it is worth pursuing that. In addition, we have always believed that there was an advantage in terms of the economics and in the cost structure to, if such a project was going to occur, if you were going to build a spur line that came off in Delta Junction, came down through Glen Allen and into the Palmer area of Cook Inlet, that there was a tremendous advantage to doing that on the front side of the big project as opposed to the back side or during the big project. And as such, if the signals are favorable, in a little over a year from now, we believe we would be in a position through the permissions we're obtaining right now, the wetlands determination, the EIS process, to go ahead and move forward in a pre-bill mode. And we also believe at that time the option exists to provide additional gas on up to Fairbanks or at least to the Delta Junction area to service some of those needs. Beyond that, the project in terms of connecting Delta Junction and Palmer, that project has a price tag of about $1.25 billion, depending on the circumstances under which you take on the project. There are a lot of other shorter-term projects that meet energy needs. We would not necessarily see those as ANGDA funding projects, but we certainly, again, would encourage the other public corporations of the state, in particular ADA, to consider seriously the financing of both a propane facility on the North Slope, a wholesale propane facility, and the Fairbanks natural gas LNG facility. And again, we would expect in either case that those would be commercial loans and that they would be awarded on a fiduciary basis after due diligence.
Madam Chair, I got more confused with the answer than with my question. So, Harold, I know and the Chair certainly knows the deliverability issues that were faced by the South Central natural gas market, some of the cold weather this winter. So when you say you're going to send gas to Fairbanks, are you talking about sending it up a $1.3 billion pipe to Fairbanks, because you're doing right-of-way work now, you're going to, that $1.3 billion, you're ready to commence construction of a spur line now from Cook Inlet to the Glen Allen area and propose pipe to Fairbanks? And would you be specific, is that pipe for purpose of space heat or is it for kilowatt generation?
Representative Ramos, the project we have looked at called Beluga to Fairbanks, B2F, is a project that if it had existed this last summer in July when the challenge was put on the table, we believe that Golden Valley Electric would have happily taken about 17 million cubic feet a day of gas delivered through such a pipeline and been able to offer to its consumer owners a considerable savings in the electric rate. That project on a pre-bill basis and trying to work all the other issues related to it would still, we believe, in the future offer an opportunity. As far as a gas source for it, we have not specifically obtained that at this point, but I would observe that one of the contracts that was disapproved over a year ago by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska was a contract for 60 billion cubic feet between Marathon and NSTAR. If that contract was available to us and We felt we could pay a couple dollars more than was included in the contract. That would provide more than sufficient gas to meet the Golden Valley Electric's needs.
And so, Madam Chair, so your $1.3 billion pipeline, you're prepared, A, you're prepared to do your right-of-way and pursue building it, and B, that 17 million cubic feet a day that would have serviced the debt on a $1.3 billion pipeline?
We believe that the economics of the uses of that pipeline between Palmer and Delta Junction and the service of all the customers along the way, including the customers at the Palmer end, would provide sufficient revenue stream to service that debt.
What kind of a tariff, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, what kind of a tariff does 17 million cubic feet a day generate? A reasonable tariff, you know, of say, even $5 an M, how much of a tariff is that? Does that service the debt on $1.3 billion?
Representative Remus, through the chair, as I remember, something like 17 million cubic feet a day works out to about 6 or 7 billion cubic feet a year. Let's see, last July, I think probably if the tariff had been in excess of as much as, say, even $10, that still would have been a favorable circumstance. So what would that be? $70 million.
So, Madam Chair, so a $10 tariff on 17 million cubic feet a day would service a $1.3 billion pipeline. Is that what?
Representative Ramirez, I didn't say that was the tariff. I just simply said that you could afford a $10 tariff and probably still be money ahead, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Any other questions for Harold Hines? Okay. Laura, did you want to? I think Representative Tuck had a permanent fund question. Did you want to ask Laura your question from earlier?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Harold. Appreciate you being here. And just hang on in case we have some more questions.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Just for the record, your name and affiliation.
Thanks, my name is Laura Ashe. I'm the Director of Communications for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think my answers are kind of getting there a little bit, but my questions or answers to my questions. But basically, in this bill, I don't see that there is, I'm all for issuing bonds, low interest bonds, especially so that the state can get some future revenues. I'm just trying to determine under this bill, what are the potential revenues that we can be coming from the state? Because nothing's really spelled out concrete. But it sounds like it's going to be coming through the negotiations process of the individual bond issuers. Am I understanding that correctly? Anyone who wants to answer?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, those would be not questions for the permanent fund. I can answer questions about whether or not we would invest in bonds and what our authorities are for investment. But those other questions, I think, would be better directed to the Department of Revenue or some of the staff or the other public corporations and bond, the agencies that have authority to issue bonds.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. Typically, right now, what kind of interest rate are you receiving for the bonds that you're letting, and do you anticipate $1 billion loan to a project like this would get the approximate same interest rate that you're averaging right now?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, our total bond portfolio right now is in the neighborhood of about $8 billion, and it's a very diverse portfolio. I can't give you a single, this is the return we're getting on anyone. It's well-diversified across type of bond, across yield, across duration. Essentially, some of the questions that I heard being asked earlier of Representative Chenault when he was up here, I would give the same answer as far as whether any of these bonds would be interesting to the investment staff of the permanent fund solely depends on where we are on the day that they're issued, and we'd have to review them at that time.
Any other question for Laura? Thank you, Laura. Jerry, I don't want to put you on the spot, but are you available for questions?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks. Just for the name and affiliation, please, for the record.
For the record, Jerry Burnett. I'm Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue for the Treasury Division. I didn't catch all of Representative Tuck's question, but if you'd like to answer it, ask it again.
Sure. I don't even know if I'm really asking it correctly, but through the chair, on here we in this bill proposal is we're going to allow the Permanent Fund Corporation to begin investing in in-state energy projects, granting up to I think $100 billion, and then $1 billion and $250 million going to different corporations and authorities. And I was just curious, nothing's really spelled out of what the rate of return would be for our permanent fund dividend or even for the state of Alaska. But I believe from hearing testimony that it sounds like it's going to be negotiated at the time that the bond proposals are going to be available. Am I correct in that or am I mistaken?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, what we're talking about here is these various corporations. Let's take ANGDA for an example. They would go out and propose some revenue bond based on income, an income stream to them. And at current time, revenue bonds, depending on what their rating is, and I don't know what their rating would be and the rating of the project, the underlying credits, you're looking at revenue bonds selling for probably 5.5, if assuming they could be tax exempt, okay. AAA rated revenue bonds today were upwards of 5.25%, and this would be not AAA most likely, so it would be a higher rate than that. Today, a year ago, the answer would probably have been 1% less than that. Next year, it may be some other amount, and there's been a tremendous variability in the spreads for various credit ratings over the past year. The difference between an A-rated credit and a AA-rated credit this week is probably over 1% difference. So this is going to be very project specific, and specific to the. To the entity issuing the debt. I think Harold Hines' point in his testimony is that if tax-exempt rates typically are below taxable rates, and if a state entity or state corporation can issue debt at a tax-exempt rate, it may be significantly below the interest rate on a taxable bond on that same project, which would then flow, the savings would flow to the consumer ultimately.
Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Jerry. It's so nice to see you as always. I respect you enormously. Does the administration support this bill?
Through the chair to Representative Ramirez. I notice your labels are backwards here, so I could be confused as to who you are. But the administration has not taken a position on this bill, as far as I know. I came here to listen to the bill, and to learn about it, not to take a position on it.
Thank you. And a follow-up, please, Madam Chair.
Representative Ramirez.
Does the administration, as far as you know, have any plans to try and get NSTAR and ANGDA together in the same room to reestablish a dialogue on a public-private partnership?
To the chair, Representative Ramos, I can't speak to that issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if this is a pertinent question or not, but I know that the U.S. Congress has, I believe, passed a guarantee of $18 billion to back the building of a gas line from Alaska. Would that have any effect on the bond rating for this other project, or are there two separate issues? Or
through the chair, Representative Peterson, I don't believe that it would have any effect specifically on this. That it's a separate issue, and so that flows to the big pipeline.
Okay, thank you. That's what I thought.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Burnett? Seeing none, thank you, Jerry, very much. Welcome. Sorry about pulling out of the audience there. Mm-hmm. Okay, is there anybody else that wishes to testify on this? Okay, Paul.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Foos. I was formerly the chairman of the board of ADA and the Energy Authority, so I know quite a bit about how this public financing goes. I was also one of the authors of the initiative for ANGDA, so I know quite a bit about that. And the reason I support this bill is because it keeps your options open. And I think that's one of the most important concepts we need to have. We talked a lot during AGEA about, you know, some of the issues of trying to pick a winner, one winner, or just trying to say which way we're going to go. And I think there's probably even more uncertainty now than there was at the time when we were considering AGEA about what's going to actually happen with getting a gas supply to Alaskans. And when you see an authorization for a bond like this, it is permissive. It's not mandating that they sell it. It's not an appropriation. And for some of Representative Ramirez's questions on this, it's actually in ANGDA's charter that the bond of ANGDA is the debt of the authority, not of the state. It does not threaten the full faith and credit of the state, and it has to be based on revenue. So if they went out with a bond and there was not sufficient revenue to pay for it, what you've got is a third-party check of the market. They would never be able to sell that bond. So it's right in the charter of ANGDA. So I think you have some protections there. The reason why you might want to lean forward and allow this issuance of bonds, you would look at the Wyoming Gas Line Port Authority. And they had a similar issue there where they had problems financing their gas line. And their problem is they had so many potential producer. Every farmer had a well on their site and all these different owners. And they put it all together and got a very large pipeline going. And they didn't have to end up using any of their bonding authority. But the fact that it was there and that people knew that that potential was there to back up those bonds is what made that project happen. Now, since then, and these authorities are always tasked with looking out for the overall public good. That's why the ANGDA has also looked at value-added processing, bringing propane to rural Alaska, looking at western, you know, Alaska gas lines, and anything that can bring a public benefit to the consumers of the state of Alaska. So, you know, that's also in their charge. But like for Wyoming, what they're looking at is they produce a lot of this gas, they produce a lot of water. They had problems with reinjecting. Well, the farmer needed water. So now they're looking at doing a pipeline to bring the produced water to the farmers for irrigation. So, you know, there are just a lot of potentials that we could end up with, and I think that's within the charter of that. Most of these projects are end up being like utilities for the benefit of the consumers. I do live in the Anchorage Electric Light and Power area, and I'm very glad somebody had the foresight many years ago to buy into the Beluga gas field. Our electric rates are about half of what they are in the rest of Anchorage because of that. So I also just wanted to make the point, if you decide to move this forward, you're not making an either-or decision on a public or a private project here. And I think the best outcome is a public, is a combination of those two. And I appreciate Representative Ramirez, just for having worked around this a long time, I was very glad to see the governor announce a potential partnership between them, and that's probably the best outcome. So I hope that that can happen. But by the same token, I do know that if ANGDA does supply tax-exempt financing, there's going to be the expectation that some of that cost savings ends up in the consumer's pocket, not just as private profit to a corporation. So those are just some of the issues as I see them. I hope I've helped shed a little light upon this, and I think it's a good bill to keep your issues, your options open, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Paul, just for the record, can you tell me who you're representing today?
I'm representing myself as a consumer of South Central Alaska. I do not have any clients in this matter.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johansson.
No, thank you.
Okay. Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for the record, Mr. Foos is extraordinarily passionate on this issue. We traveled to Beijing with Governor Hickel and Speaker Harris at the time, and Senator Huggins from the other body. So it's a big passion issue for Paul, which I appreciate. Paul, who do you see in the market, the universe of people that would offer these bonds for ANGDA? Do you see it as a market larger than the permanent fund? I mean, what's the there's a relationship here that the permanent fund may invest an amount of $1 billion, and then it appears that Section 3 is really unrelated to this. Section 3 really just expands the weatherization program that's been so successful with Alaska Housing. Who else, what other entity in the universe of the credit market do you think would be interested in financing $250 million in bonds for ANGDA?
Representative Ramos, through the chair. Generally, when a debt goes out like this from a state agency or even from a municipal agency within the state, you try to bundle them into larger bond offerings. So let's say ADA had a bond going out for something else, or you had a state general obligation bond, or the railroad had something, you would try to bundle those to actually get a better rate or take advantage of going in with somebody, another entity that had a better bond rating. So these bond managers, when they go out to sell them, I mean, they look at it, they'll even say, we're going to get a better rate in 2 days, so we'll sell it in 2 days or whatever, but they try to bundle those together. So there could be a larger universe, but it's the general commercial market, and it's all based upon the creditworthiness of the bonds and of the ability to pay it back and their belief that the revenues will be sufficient to do that.
So, Madam Chair, follow up.
Okay,
so do you think that if the ANGDA bonds were bundled with the $100 million authorization for Alaska Housing, for instance, do you think that it might increase the rate that Alaska Housing had to pay? Because, as Jerry stated, a bond of a lesser grade would be married up to the Alaska Housing bonds, which I assume are AAA because of the sterling reputation, the full faith and credit of the state of Alaska stands behind Alaska Housing. So could the bonding package, if it was bundled, end up costing Alaska Housing more as a result?
Representative Ramnitz, through the chair. I don't know the answer to that, but if for any of these bonding issues, if the committee would really like to look at this, probably one of the most qualified people in the entire state of Alaska is Dan Fauske, the head of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and he's dealt with this. He was on the board with me when I was at ADA. He was the finance officer for the North Slope, so he might be a very solid resource for the committee to ask that question to.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions for Paul? Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I heard you right when you were speaking of before the previous questions, you were saying that the good faith and credit of the state of Alaska and the Permanent Fund Board, just them being behind this project would make it be seen as more of a viable project by other possible potential people that were going to maybe buy these bonds. Is that correct?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, there is no intermingling with the permanent fund. That is a completely separate section of the bill. What I was saying is that when you go out to sell bonds, sometimes when you sell a larger bond, you get a larger investment pools interested in it. So it would be commingling with other like-type agencies, ADA, the Housing Finance Corporation, the railroad, something like that, not the permanent fund.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Foose?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? Nope. Anybody else online that would like to testify? Close public testimony. Any committee discussion on the bill? Nope. Representative Bellstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wish to make a motion, and that is to move the CS for House Bill number 44, version R, with attached show, physical note, and individual recommendations from committee.
Any objections? Hearing none. CS for House Bill 44 has moved out of committee. Individual recommendations. Thank you. And with that, the Energy Committee has no meeting on Thursday and no meeting on Saturday. We'll be meeting next Tuesday at our regularly scheduled time. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.